Welcome to episode number 107 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we bring in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story or topic from video game history / video games to tell. See, I changed it up there. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm usually here with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, but he's out today, so it will just be me and our guest today, who is Steve Lin, longtime video game collector, historian, and board member of the Video Game History Foundation. And I think this is the first time we've had a board member on this show.
Yeah, I think so. It only took us 106 episodes to get here. But, really excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Steve, welcome to the show. Today, we're going to be talking about something that you're currently going through. And just as a real quick content warning for people, we are going to be discussing death a little bit today. It's probably not going to go into any super scary territory here, but we are kind of on the topic of what you do with your video game collection. Actually, let me back up. It's more like video game collection as a form of preservation and kind of how that works throughout your life and past your life. Does that sound right? Is that?
Yeah, it sounds right. I mean, I think you're saying like, oh, something I'm going through right now. I'm not actively dying.
He's not dying. Now, yeah.
I'm going through the planning process of what to do if something were to happen to me. And I think we're going to talk about our experiences with that and some of the things to think about as you look at your collection.
So, I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, you're not dying. So why is this something that you are like looking at right now with your collection?
Well, this is something, yeah. I mean, it's something that you don't think about until it's too late. And you know, we have a lot of stories at the foundation and sort of personally where people have reached out to us and said, hey, my relative has died and you know, they have an extensive collection or they're a developer and they don't know what to do. And they're kind of out there. And there's a lot of other implications that we can get into later in terms of inheritance and taxation and what to do with all this stuff. But we've run into it enough times to where I think that we can talk about what it means to plan these things before it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, I have a bunch of stuff too that I haven't started thinking about really, other than, you know, kind of telling my partner and telling the people at the foundation that, hey, you know, this stuff is yours when I'm gone. It belongs to the foundation, whatever the foundation wants, or it could be sold. But I mean, none of that is written down. And I have no idea how well that would be executed in the event of my passing. So, I mean, it definitely is something that I think getting out in front of is probably smart to do. And you mentioned, you know, we've had a lot of people at the foundation who have kind of come to us kind of in instances where there has not been any communication, where there has not been any planning. And we're very, very thankful that people come to us at all in those situations. But I think there's probably dozens, if not hundreds more, that never reach out in the first place, that, you know, have no idea that we exist and, you know, have no idea to even go that far. And so I don't know that we know what we've lost, but I imagine it's fairly substantial.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's come through us almost by accident or like friend of a friend of a friend where they said, hey, try reaching out to this person. And it just so happens to land on our doorstep. And we also can't engage with every single thing that comes our way, right? We're limited resources. In some cases, we can fly out, but that's very rare. And if you look at someone like Chris Oberth's collection, you know, when he passed away, his family realized, you know, this person was a developer and we have all these discs, but we don't know what to do with them. And it was sort of evaluating that and trying to help the family as much as possible in the aftermath.
Right. Because, I mean, you also have the Chris Oberth situation is a good example of this. You also have examples where, you know, they understand that some of this stuff might be historically notable and they also need some financial help. You know, they really need to kind of make something back on all of this work they're putting in. And so, you end up with some kind of delicate situations like that where you're, I mean, I guess doing triage essentially on, you know, how can we make this the best outcome for everyone involved? How can we make sure that the really historically important stuff gets preserved while also not, you know, hurting a family that needs to be able to make some money off of this in order to kind of, you know, pay for funeral services and all of that. So yeah, it can definitely be a delicate balance. And that's, again, even that's in the scenario where someone actually does connect with us and there's, you know, who knows how many more that don't. So I don't know, let's start with your stuff. I mean, you have an incredible collection. I mean, how long have you been collecting at this point?
It's almost easier to say, when have I not been collecting? So yeah, I think I still have ColecoVision games from, you know, when I was 8 years old. So,
wow.
I sort of collecting in earnest, probably in my early teen years. I think I've talked about this on other podcasts, but, I realized that a lot of things weren't being saved. And I was trying to find like-minded people. And at that time it was really mailing things to each other, right? We had Mike Etler's list of NES games, and we had, then news groups came along and we were able to find ways of connecting that way or through zines. I was trying to make sure that whatever I saw that wasn't on any of these lists was documented. And I happened to be working at a used game store, at that time. And so we were throwing out like boxes, manuals, and, you know, this is the transition from, 8-bit to 16-bit. And I just was just buying up everything cheap because there was a lot of things that were showing up that I had never seen before.
And this is in a time, before game collecting was really, I mean, anything resembling the hobby it is now. Like you said, a very small community of people. And not only that, we didn't even have a canonized list of like what video games exist. And so, you know, I still believe that game collecting is a form of preservation, but I think especially going back that far, it was the groundwork of preservation. It was, you know, putting together the list of literally what exists. You know, you have to have that before you can do any amount of saving, right? Like you have to know what's missing and okay, we are aware that this game exists, but no one's ever seen the manual for it and who's going to take photos of that or scan it and put it online. So, you know, your collection started out, I mean, was it mostly preservation minded for you when you started out? You just were trying to kind of complete these lists and figure it out?
Yeah, I mean, I started by just, you know, trying to get one of everything, right? So it was like the typical, like, I want to collect everything. I wouldn't get duplicates, right? So I passed on like my second stadium events because I already had it, right?
Yeah,
like,
who needs that?
And at the time it was like a $10 card, right? So it doesn't matter. But over time I realized that I was seeing fewer boxes and manuals. And for me, that was a part of the experience of game shopping. And then very early on started also collecting like ephemera, right? And like things related to the advertising of games. And in my head, I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll, especially as a younger person, I was like, maybe I'll open a museum someday. And then as I learned more, it's like, there's no way I would ever open a museum, but this stuff can be important. And so I always knew that it would be going to those efforts. I just wasn't sure exactly how that was going to happen. And then especially over time, you know, more recently, like you're saying, game collecting is at a lot different place. And so I haven't felt the need to, for instance, collect every Xbox 360 game or PS4, right? I've gotten, and when new things pop up, I'll usually make sure they just get directed to whoever, wherever it should go anyway. It doesn't need to go through my hands.
Yeah. And I mean, the ephemera stuff, I think, especially is some of the, well, you know what? I'm gonna jump ahead a little bit here because mm-hmm. we do want to talk about at some point what you want out of your game collection when you go or even before you go to try to figure out like what is the purpose of all of this. And it's totally okay if the purpose is just, you know, for my own enjoyment, and then later I'll sell it all and it'll be fine. But we are at a point now where it's probably not super important for most museums to take in retail games, right? But you have a lot of stuff that is not just retail games, and I think that's kind of the majority of what you're working on right now. I want to dive into that a little bit. I mean, you had this idea first of opening your own museum, and then I'm guessing at some point you were like, okay, maybe there's a museum I can give this to. What was that process like? And, you know, when you're talking to these institutions, what are you hearing back from them about what they're looking for?
Well, when I first looked at, you know, there was always I'll have a museum and it's all the games. But then you realize that's a pretty boring museum, right? It's like, oh, look, it's all the games on the wall. I mean, we do the pop-up at PRGE and things like that, but that's not really a destination type of thing. And so it was more, all right, why do museums exist? Well, they're there to tell stories, right? And act as resources for people who are doing research. And in talking with a lot of museums, you know, even with the Strong, which is where I have the strongest relationship, no pun intended, you know, they don't necessarily need all the games, right? It's like, okay, we don't necessarily even want all the games.
Well, and even if they do, they're not displaying them like that.
Correct.
I mean, I think that the way that, I've spoken to a lot of people who, you know, have this notion that there should be a museum of all of the video games. And the analogy I always use to just kind of blow it up a little bit and show why that might not be as interesting as you think is, try to imagine a car museum of all of the cars, just, you know, every iteration of Toyota Corolla and Honda Civic. And, you know, like you almost lose the good stories in the bulk when you just have a wall of something. Now, that being said, you mentioned, you know, we do a pop-up museum at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo every year, which almost always features a beautiful, complete collection of some system. And I think it's a gorgeous set piece, and I think people like looking at it, but it's not telling much of a story, or at the very least, it's, you know, I don't know that you could have a museum of just that. It's a really, really pretty and cool thing to go look at and be like, wow, that's it. That's all of them. But, you know, expanded times the number of systems in the world, I don't know that that it keeps being as novel.
Yeah, I mean, it is the curation, right? And so it is having things for them to pull out from if they want to do a display telling a specific type of story. And so, you know, I said like an auction description or a museum description is the eulogy to that object, right? And it allows people to emotionally connect with whatever that thing is. And the best eulogies are written by those who knew the person or that object the best, right? And so if something is personal to you or you understand its importance, it's making sure that other people know that as well, so it doesn't die with you. So for the Strong, it is a lot of the paperwork, right? A lot of the promotional material or things that I got at press events and E3s of long past. And then specific like historical items, right? Like the NES games used in the court case of Magnavox versus Nintendo, right? Those are very specific artifacts that tell a really interesting story that was really important to the industry. And so, you know, there's going to be all this other stuff that I'm going to have to sell. And, you know, Kelsey, you hit on it earlier. That's a big part of this as well, is there's a lot of people when someone passes away that they need the money, right? And or they were told that this was worth some ridiculous amount of money. And they're like, okay, how do I turn video games into cash? And that can be a lot more complicated than simply like, oh, of course, everybody knows this goes to my, you know, spouse or my kids. Before I go into this part, I guess I want to have the caveat that I am not a lawyer or a CPA. This is not legal or tax advice. This is, you know, just based off what I've learned from my personal experience. And it's also very U.S. centric. But I think that a lot of these sort of principles do apply, like, no matter who you are. And like you said, your partner knows where things should go. Frank knows where things should go. But I think we've joked, like, you, me, Frank, Chris Kohler can never be on the same airplane, right? Because if it crashes, then each of our backups is gone, right? In terms of the people who really understand the collection. And so having, like, at the very least, and it doesn't matter how old you are, because you can never predict when something bad's going to happen. You know, one of the things that kind of pushed me to do this was I had had cancer, right? I'm, you know, 10 years in remission, but I was pretty young when I was diagnosed. And it's like, oh my gosh, this could be it. And you never know when that's going to happen. And so even having something, you know, the basics, like a will, right? And you know, the will is just effectively instructions on where you want things to go. But even recognizing with a will, you still have to go through, at least in California, through probate, right? A judge has to look at this and say, okay, I agree with this piece of paper. And now things can be distributed. And because there's usually a backup, this could take months or even years, especially if it's contested. Right, like you're saying, if a lot of money is involved, like we've seen horrible, like family battles around these types of things, and so,
you know, and that money does not need to be cash. It can be, you know, valuable video games or
or sentimental, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that there's a lot of that happens, and so really all of this is to make life easier for those that you leave behind, because it's already a super difficult time. You know, I've gone through it personally a number of times, and the last thing you want to think about is a court system or paperwork or like, what do I do with this giant room of things, right? That I may know nothing about, right? The thing is, game collecting is usually your hobby. It's not necessarily shared at the same level of passion by other people in your household or in your friend network, and just recognizing that they're not going to have the same attachment that you do.
And not only that, I mean, to learn of, you know, to learn of someone's passing and be dealing with that, and then also be kind of given this enormous task of figuring out what to do with a house full of objects, and particularly a collection that, you know, your loved ones probably understand is important to you, but may not understand exactly what that means, or how they should deal with it. You know, that is a large undertaking to leave for people. I mean, both of my parents are still with me, but when my mom's parents passed away, I went with her to the house, and just you know, a basement full of objects that we had to figure out what to do with. And, you know, I know those decisions were not easy especially on my mom. I assume you've kind of gone through similar trials in dealing with that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've lost both my parents, and in one case it was more sudden than the other, but you know, even with like everything planned out, right? We had all the paperwork. We had been able to talk through things, and like, this is what's going to happen. All that was set up and was still really difficult. And so not knowing and having, you know, all this ambiguity just makes it incredibly challenging for those left behind. And so whatever you can do to ease that burden, and also to make sure that, you know, it sort of adheres with your wishes, right? You're not around, so you can't do anything about it, but what do you want to happen to your collection, right? And so for people with the larger collections, there are also things like trusts, right? Like living trust, revocable trust. And I would recommend that you look at it, because those things can sort of bypass things like probate, and they can there's some tax benefits to it, and you can control timing and details and everything else that just makes life easier. And you know, it's not cheap, but if you have a substantial collection, I would also recommend that you at least explore it to see what it would mean for everybody else.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit how that works? I'm actually not super familiar with that versus a traditional will.
Yeah. So the will basically says, hey, here's like the instructions. The trust is like, here are the things that exist and now are part of this trust. Now, you don't lose control over it, right? So you have control over the trust, but it technically belongs to the trust. And then you appoint a trustee. And like I said, I'm not a lawyer, so I might be getting some of the details wrong here. But the trustee is basically the one who distributes it. So it's like, okay, you know, this person gets this, this person gets this, this money goes here, this money goes there. It's basically like a sort of pre-approved distribution document. So you don't have to do, you don't have to necessarily go through the courts.
So let's talk a little bit about what is important for people to do right now, or like what are kind of the checklist of, you know, bare minimums you should be trying to hit right now. I mean, I think for me, the first thing I would say is just simply getting down somewhere kind of the scope of what you own, right? Like literally what is in your collection, and are there some highlights, like some things you want to, make sure are understood to be important. So for example, in my collection, I have a slightly early version of a Wonderswan color with different buttons and a different face. I hesitate to call it like prototype because it was, I don't know enough about the development history to know where exactly this fell in the timeline, but that looks very similar to the rest of them in my collection. And even someone, I think I've talked about the Wonderswan enough that most people in my life are like vaguely familiar with it, but it's just a Wonderswan with a slightly different screen and slightly different buttons. And someone may just be like, ah, okay, this is a Wonderswan and it's worth, $40 or whatever. And I know in our notes here, you brought up a really good one, which is the difference between a Daytona on the Saturn and Daytona Netlink edition on the Saturn, which have the exact same UPC and a difference of several thousand dollars.
Yeah. I mean, your Wonderswan example is a great one because even if you threw me into a room, I don't know if I would immediately notice the difference, right? And I play on Wonderswans. I'm like, oh, is this button different, right? And that's one of the reasons. Like when you're in Japan, you look for like the square button Famicom, right? Is someone going to notice that those buttons are square and not circles? So the big thing, first of all, is documenting what you have. And if you don't want to tackle the whole thing, definitely pointing out the unusual or very special things within the collection. I would recommend, hey, just open up a Google document, do a quick write up, and maybe have a picture of it, right? So that when people are going through, like your loved ones, like, okay, this is the stuff that they said was really important, and why is it important? I think that's the other piece, because some pieces can be sentimental. Right. It's like I only kept this because it means something to me personally, but it's not necessarily valuable. Right. And then there's other things that like, hey, I might have, this is a prototype of X. Right. And here's
for the Game Boy.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's like, well, some of these things are more valuable than others. There are apps. In fact, this is something that I've been going through more recently as I've been trying to do. I had spreadsheets, but this is making it a lot easier.
Yeah. What did you end up going with? Cause you did ask my advice with that. And I was like, I'm saddled with one that I started a long time ago and don't love. But here's some other ones that I think are good.
Yeah. I mean, I was using like Delicious Library and those like a long time ago, but I ended up going with CLZ, the collectors. It doesn't do hardware very well, which I've been having to do manually. But
I don't think any of them do.
No, I mean that hardware is rough, right? That is just I think that there's too many there's a lot of variations of the same thing, and that's the thing. I'm even noticing that with this app where Daytona and Daytona Netlink, right? And slight variations, or it doesn't scan, but it gets you like 95% of the way there. And all you have to do is just like point it to the barcode. And if for most people's collections, the stuff you have in there, it's going to be in there, right? You probably don't have like a drawer full of prototypes or one-offs or something like that. And so what that does is basically creates a record, and then you export that and do it in a shared, you know, Google Sheet or whatever with other people in your household, right? And one of the things it does, which, I mean, this is where it gets complicated or can get tricky, is it can also update with price trading values, right? But that is something that I think we run into all the time. It's like, they told me it was worth X, right? Like, oh, they said this collection was worth $100,000. But if you try to sell it, you might get $100,000 if you spend 2 years selling on eBay, right?
Well, and even then, eBay takes 15% just off the top. Right. Like, so you might get $85,000. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to ship it out. It's like, selling on eBay is a pain, right? And so when we talk about like capturing the value of the collection, that there's, it's more like a guide, like this is a more valuable game than this, but don't say that like, I'm going to, you know, wave a magic wand over this copy of Musha and like $800 is going to appear. Right. That's not how it works. And so I think that, you know, in my case, it's in there just to give sort of relative values, but I don't actually say that this is exactly what it's worth in the market.
Well, and especially when you get to, you know, expensive, but very small market items. Like, I mean, like some of my Wonderswan stuff where I paid a lot of money for it, but good luck finding someone else who's going to pay that amount of money for it. So,
right. And it's like you and that one other person you're bidding against.
Right. Sorry. So I assume there are things like that in your collection, and there's probably things like that in a lot of collections. The other thing that kind of, that especially doing that highlighting, you know, that very first thing where you're just kind of highlighting mm-hmm. the important stuff or the interesting stuff, is that is going to be so much easier for, you know, if your wishes are that whatever would be accepted by a museum, go to a museum or an archive or some other institution, most of them are not going to really want to take the time to dig through 2,000 retail games to just see if there's anything worth it in there for them. Like that is a lot of work for both the person who's dealing with your collection and also for the museum that you're kind of pitching it to. So I think at least starting with it, you know, giving people that thing to start with and be like, okay, these are the items that I think might be historically important, might be actually worth your time to like try selling individually, those sort of things. I mean, like, that gives a really good starting point and kind of position to put your stuff in, especially as you're, like we mentioned, you know, there's not a lot of places that are just looking for 1,000 retail games. They, you know, might already have them, or they just have decided that, you know, their space is better allocated to other stuff.
Yeah, when you talk about space, that's a big one, right? We know folks who have donated to museums and then realized very quickly that they just deaccessioned or potentially even threw away some of those things because they ran out of storage, right? And like, well, what did I do that for? And if when you mention things that are of historic importance, right? I think this is actually something that belongs in a museum, like truly belongs in a museum. I highly recommend creating that relationship with the museum ahead of time, right? And talking with them and saying, hey, is this important? And in some cases, you know, I have things that are already on loan to the Strong, and it's going to transfer over to them for, you know, relatively soon, but it's already in their hands, right? And you know, so you already know it's going to be there. And you know, this stuff doesn't need to live in my house. But this all goes back to the question of, you know, what do you want to happen to your collection? What are you collecting for? And in my case, it's, I was collecting to preserve a lot of these things. And now that there are, you know, there's the foundation, which is doing a ton of great work with preservation. There are very specific museums that I think are doing great work in terms of providing access to researchers. That's where it can go. I don't need to have it in my house anymore.
Yeah. And I think, the foundation especially does a lot of work with kind of trying to nudge people towards the best place for their items. I mean, we do get contacted about potential donations fairly often that we turn down because, quite frankly, we're just not the right spot for it. And I assume that the Strong does the same thing. I don't know how much, you know, redirecting they've done, if any, for stuff that they're not interested in. But, you know, in our case, we don't collect retail games at all in our archive. I mean, it is our reason for doing it at the foundation is mostly because it is something that is already being done very well by other institutions. There are a lot of institutions who have collected very impressive amounts of retail games that can already be kind of studied. There's a lot of people working on scanning all of the boxes and all of the manuals. And like, I don't know if you know this, but basically every ROM that came on a cart or a CD or DVD, that's pretty much all out there already. So, you know, that's basically something that we've decided, you know, could we be helping on that? We could, but we think our limited resources are much better pointed at things that don't have this much work being done on them. So where am I going with this? Basically,
well, I mean, you're hitting it in the head. Like, these places don't want your stuff most of the time, right? Because they have limited resources. Like, oh, of course they would want like my giant loose collection of Atari 2600 games. Like, why? You know, what are we going to do with it? And we have most museums, nonprofits, research groups don't have a lot of funding or a lot of staff, right? And so it's how
we're
do we
best use our time?
Yeah, exactly. Like we're talking about, so even places we know have what you would consider to be a significant amount of storage still have to make trade-offs in terms of what they keep and what they deaccession. And so I think that it is really important to think, you know, when we talk about what do you want to do with your collection, also recognizing that prices tend, outside of specific items, prices tend to go down, right? If you look at, for instance, Elvis memorabilia or like HO train sets, and it's like there are these things that used to be extremely valuable and they've been on a decline. And of course, there's outliers, right, that they're worth a lot more. But that's not everything, and it's probably not most of your collection.
Yeah, and I know that's kind of a weird thing to say when we're still sort of in a bubble with this with video game collecting. And like you said, there's a lot of exceptions. I'm sure the games that are expensive right now will continue to be, you know, for the most part, more expensive than the other games. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you were a game collector when the focal point of game collecting was Atari. And Atari yeah. games in, you know, in like the late 90s and stuff were kind of what retro game collecting was centered around, because, I mean, games weren't really all that retro yet is a big part of it. But I think most people know now that like the vast majority of Atari 2600 games are pretty worthless. I mean, mm-hmm.
In television too, right?
Yeah.
I think that there was like people getting into in television collecting and yeah, like even like loose Atari 2600 games were commanding, you know, by what we see now in like NES loose, but not maybe to the same scale, but it was, and that was the hot thing. And I was the guy at World of Atari looking through dollar bins of NES games because that was the junk at the time. Right. And
that's how you stay ahead of the game collecting curve, by the way, right. Buy PS4 now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I was scanning things, I'm like, well, some of this Wii U stuff is getting expensive. And like GameCube is, I didn't even realize where that is now.
Oh, but, yeah. Well, I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense because it's Nintendo and everyone loves Nintendo and it's a very collectible system. And the GameCube and the Wii U, outside of the Virtual Boy, are the worst selling Nintendo consoles of all time. So they, you know, I know everyone knew someone that had a GameCube, but the actual amount of games out there, not that many. I think they sold about 8 million GameCubes, which the PS2 sold 120 million for reference. So
bit of a scale difference.
Yeah.
I mean, Kelsey, do you have experiences in the store with people bringing things in that they've inherited or have sort of found in closets?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, the famous one that we were in the news for was that someone came in who, it actually wasn't like an inherited collection, but it was just, he had kind of done what you did, but very casually for just a couple of years, where he would pick up NES games at garage sales and that sort of thing. And he was like, oh yeah, all this stuff that I grabbed at garage sales in my 20s or whatever and came in and, you know, we're pulling games out of the bag and it's like baseball, 10-yard fight, you know, whatever, just very random low-value games. And then Nintendo World Championship at the bottom of that bag. And yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't me that was handling the trade, but my business partner, and he genuinely thought we were being punked. Like, you know, it was the last game he pulled out of the bag. And he was like, is this a joke? Like, the guy had no idea. And of course, we are very ethical, I am very proud to say, and, you know, explain to him exactly what the value of it was at the time, and made him as high of an offer as we possibly could and kind of explained what that would be. But, you know, that guy was going in and he told us straight up he was expecting about $50 for the whole stack. So, I mean, that is absolutely a, you know, just to kind of call back to when we're saying, hey, you might want to at least highlight the things in there that are particularly important. If that guy had just plopped that down somewhere else and said, I just want $50 for the bag, you know, someone who is maybe a little less ethical or a little more enterprising, better businesswoman, I don't know, might have just given him $50, you know, and he would have been fine with that. But yeah, we've definitely had a lot of people bring in collections that they are just kind of not sure what to do with. And it doesn't always have to be through someone passing away. It can just be, you know, a roommate moved out and left all of this stuff or something along those lines. But, you know, it's, I always, you know, hope for these people that they at least have some idea of what they're bringing in. If they're bringing it to us, it's fine, but you never know if they're bringing it somewhere else. And again, if they want $50 for the bag and they say that, then there might be people out there that are just like, great, I'll give you $50 for the bag. So I think that in a lot of cases, though, just selling the collection is a perfectly reasonable thing to expect, you know, to be the end point for most of your collection when you're gone. I mean, I really do, because as we've been talking about, there's a lot of stuff that I think is just not going to make sense or may not make sense for an institution to take, as much as, you know, even if that's your goal, is to have it all go to a museum or an institution, you know, you can leave that in the instructions to your family, but if they try calling four places and they're like, we don't want it, you know, at some point they got to make a decision with it. So there's a lot of, I don't know, there are other things that you can do for your collection other than send it straight to a museum. And I think that getting money either for your family or just having that money go towards a cause you care about are both really, like, options that I think people should think about and talk about more. I mean, let me ask you, like, what is your, you have a lot of stuff that, I mean, as you've already said, the Strong's not really interested in taking, the foundation is probably not interested in storing. I mean, again, a lot of these institutions will be like, sure, we'll take it and we'll deaccession it and, you know, get some money to continue operating. And I think that's totally fine. But, you know, that's something that you have to know going in and be okay with. So what is your plan for the stuff that is maybe not historically important enough to be placed anywhere permanently?
Well, I mean, we're going to sell it and the proceeds going to the foundation, right? And you're 100% right. Like, very likely your collection is going to be sold, right? If it is not donated somewhere. And I mean, what do you care? You're not alive. But it's more just recognizing that your family members, friends, they probably don't have the same passion that you do. Like, there are rare cases, right, where we've seen, you know, a parent and their child kind of doing this stuff together. And those are the cases where, you know, the child takes over in many ways. But yeah, I mean, I think the other part of this question is, you know, what do you want to happen to it? And if there are other things that you want to do with the value of the collection, right, with the money, like there are certain causes that you're very passionate about, or you want to help out family members or something, like you can also sell your collection while you're still alive. This doesn't have to happen like immediately upon your death, right? And
you're probably going to do a better job of it than your family.
Yeah. In fact, I would 100% you're going to do a better job than your family, right? And I think that that's something to think about. Like I'm going through this process now, and I would say within the next couple of years, it's, you know, all this stuff is going to be done, right? I'm going to have a couple games here at home that mean something to me personally, but it will either be at the Strong or we'll be working on deaccessioning it for the foundation. And that's okay for me. I mean, it's not everybody's choice, but I don't have to own these games anymore, right? I just want them to be in you know, hands of people who can either use them for research purposes or in hands of people who will enjoy them.
And we have actually had a couple of donations like this to the foundation already, too, where someone contacts us and, you know, explains what they have. And we tell them, OK, this isn't the kind of stuff that we typically put in our archive. And they come back with, well, I still like it's important to me that this supports the foundation. And in those cases, you know, it's like, well, we can sell these for money that fund our operating costs and fund the space and the acquisition of more items that, you know, we are digitizing and putting in the archive. So, you know, we have had some people do that, but I know that there's definitely something kind of painful about that. I don't know if you feel that way or if you're just kind of over it, but I mean, I know that I have a complete Wonderswan set and a bunch of other stuff from, you know, I've got a ton of guidebooks and every Wonderswan fan magazine. And I've got, you know, some point of purchase stuff. And it's a collection that I've worked very hard on and I think is very interesting. And I think I would be sad just to see it scattered to the winds for money, even if that's, you know, ultimately the only real option for it. So I get that it's a hard pill to swallow. And I wish I had like more comforting words for that. I don't think in my case that no one would take it. I think it would at least be a cool pop-up at some point. You know, the foundation will throw it in storage or something. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't want to say like this. It's an easy decision for me, but it took me time to get here. Right. I didn't like wake up one day and was like, oh, get rid of everything. Right. It's more of like, what is the evolution? You know, where does it need to go? And in my case, it's like I believe in the foundation and obviously on the board and doing everything I can to make sure that it lasts well beyond us. Right. That it is something sustainable. And one of the ways we can do that is through money. And, you know, a bunch of Super Nintendo games, like, yeah, there's a couple that are interesting historically and we'll make sure that those go into the right place. But, you know, do I need to preserve that boxed copy of, you know, I don't know, Pocky and Rocky or PTO or something, right? And, you know, for eternity, it's like, no, that's fine. Those will be fine.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of this stuff where, the good news is there's scans of a lot of things on the internet. It's not finished yet. I mean, it's definitely a project that a lot of people are working on, and there's no such thing as a perfect scan. So it's always nice to at least know where a physical copy of something is. But again, there's a lot of places kind of already doing that, which is encouraging. So, I mean, I want to summarize a little bit here, which is that you should, as far as what you should prepare right now, you should prepare bare minimum some kind of list of what is actually important in here, actually valuable, you know, what to look out for. The better version of that is having an entire spreadsheet or collection app or something like that that kind of gives a complete overview of what there is. And then some way of writing down your wishes with this. And yeah. Then also, like, if you can, starting those conversations yourself, especially if you're trying to place it in an institution of some sort. You know, like you mentioned that you've been having conversations with the Strong for years. I recommend talking to the places that you would like to see it end up now so that they can tell you now, you know, either yes, this is awesome, or no, but maybe here's this other place that might be good for it. Again, so you don't end up with a situation where your family's contacting five museums and none of them want it, and then what do they do?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing you can do is have other people know what your wishes are, right? Make those wishes known. And I see this a lot where, you know, because you're starting to write a will, and by the way, you can do like online wills like pretty inexpensively, and that like that at the bare minimum from a legal standpoint can be extremely beneficial, even though, like I said, that there are complications with it. It still makes life easier. But there's a lot of people who don't like talking about death, right? It's like, oh, I want you to know what's valuable or why this is important or what I would like to happen with my collection. And I've seen people like brush off the conversations like, oh, no, you're perfectly healthy. You're fine. Like, we don't have to have this conversation. And yeah, I would say that I would insist on having that conversation, right? It's super important because when you're not there to answer any of these questions, right? And if someone, like you're saying, we know that Kelsey has like a rare wonder swan, right? That's something that we can look out for. It's like, oh, okay, like I know one of these, which one has a weird button, right? Or a screen or whatever. If you hadn't said that to someone, then they wouldn't know, right? And so, yeah, especially if you have a collection of any sort of value, it is really important because, like you're saying, the money aspect comes into play a lot when we talk to people in these situations. Like, hey, you know, we have all these bills, or you know, we need that money to do X, Y, or Z, and it's really hard to unlock that money. So. And even know sort of what people have. So I think that, you know, a lot of the things we said here, hopefully, if they don't put it off, right, do some of the early things. And then the bigger stuff like scanning every game and whatever, just take it in chunks. You don't have to do it all at once.
Yeah. There's actually one more thing I realized we did not talk about as part of the bringing it to institutions or donating it in general, which is transportation and costs of that. So you live on the West Coast. The Strong Museum is on the East Coast. Yep. And my guess is they are not flying out to you and arranging transportation for you. So let's talk about that for a little bit, because I think that might be something that people don't even realize. It's like, okay, yeah, I want it to go to the Strong. Even if the Strong says yes, mm-hmm. and you're gone, your family's like, okay, here it is. What do we do? And I imagine it's quite expensive to just ship it all in a box over there.
Well, to give you a sense of scale, like I have spent so far $1,000 on bins. So just the bins to put my games in. And it's like, and you're right, the logistics of shipping something like that are very complicated, right? In the case of like my collection, we will likely arrange shipping because this is something where a truck is going to need to show up, and there are things that are probably important or valuable enough to hey, you know, we can get the museum to probably cover the shipping on some of this stuff. But in general, you're right, like this stuff is big. Like if you think about how many, you know, linear feet of games you have in your house and then how much fits into a bin, sometimes you can fill a bin and it doesn't look like you made any dent in the wall.
I just moved, right? And yeah, I've got a ton of banker's boxes and I was like, you know, I filled three and I was like, man, I haven't even finished the DS shelf yet. Like, oh my God.
Yeah. So this like moving it around is extremely difficult, right? So I think that having an understanding of, you know, even how to move it around, how to like pack it, how to transport it, and make sure you're doing that sort of safely is a logistical problem in and of itself. And this is like, you know, kind of circling all the way back. All of this prep work, all this stuff that we're talking about is to make it easier for those that have to deal with this, right? Are they going to have to go and buy a couple hundred dollars worth of bins? And then, you know, emotionally, you know, all these things were really important to you, and they're you know, they're dealing with everything about that surrounds your death, and they're going to have to do this right on top of all of it. And you really don't want that unless you're like a bad person.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's any final thoughts here, but I mean, you summed it up pretty good that this is all really just to make it easier for everyone. And also to make sure that you know why you're collecting right now, even. I mean, I think that, you know, it sounds like you started off with a pretty like noble goal from the beginning, but I know most people are probably not like that. I mean, most people probably aren't 100% sure why they're collecting other than that it's a hobby they enjoy. And that is completely valid. It can just be a hobby, and it can be something that, you know, you sell off and use that money for your child's tuition or something. I mean, I think that those are all really, really good uses of, you know, just a hobby that you enjoy. But yeah, think about why you are collecting what you collect, especially if you are collecting something that, you know, might be going outside the bounds of sort of the Wikipedia knowledge out there. Like if you're going for every variant of something and maybe not all the variants are documented, I mean, make sure that you're thinking about how you want to make that known. I don't think everyone needs to like start their own blog website or anything, but like it's, if you have done something that is historically interesting or important in some way, like collecting every variant of something, you know, think about how you want that to be communicated and exist outside of your collection. And maybe it does end up in a museum somewhere, but at the very least, you probably need some sort of documentation for why the museum would be interested in this and why it's an interesting collection in and of itself. Do you have any final? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying, yeah, I mean, the collector is going through existential crises thinking about these questions after listening to the podcast. But yeah, you know, why do you have these things, right? Why? And yeah, you're right. It can be just a hobby. This is something I enjoy doing. And you know, as long as it doesn't sort of completely take over your life and you're able to sort of balance that out, that's really important. But a lot of times people say, oh, you know, I want my kids to experience these games. There's a ton of ways of experiencing these games, right? Like, you know, either through something like Virtual Console or, you know, like emulation, Mister. And if you want to hold the controller, there's plenty of ways that you can hold a controller, right? And control Mario on the screen. And so thinking about, you know, when we were kids, we didn't like go over to our wall of 776 Nintendo games and pick one off, right? It was, okay, I have this one game for the year and I'm just going to play it, even if it's terrible. And so, yeah, thinking about what you want to do, like why are you collecting, and what are the other things that could you can do with that? And, you know, if it's important to other folks in your life, finding opportunities to share more of those things that, you know, parts of my collection I've loaned to people that have been writing books or doing like game compilations and things like that. And that was really important. It's like, hey, we need box copies. And for some reason, even the publisher doesn't have them. It's like, well, here, right. Use mine. Right. And so being able to do that really helps solidify to me why it's important that this goes to a place where people who are doing projects like that are amplifying and sharing history is really important. And so that's become my focus.
Yeah. And I mean, even outside of loaning it, just, you know, photographing it or sharing it in other ways with people. I mean, we had just had Chris Kohler on recently and he helped me with my book because he received a press copy of Animal Crossing for the GameCube when it first came out. And it came with a like 2-page little press release thing that only went to the press. And, you know, we at the foundation, we have a halfway decent amount of materials, press materials for the original Animal Crossing, but we didn't have that one. And we didn't have that version of the game that the only difference is a little silver thing that says for promotional use only on the disc. But like, these are things I had to learn through someone who had a game collection. And so that's I don't know. I think that's a very fun example of ways your collection might be able to help people researching.
I mean, sharing that knowledge, right? I posted the pictures of the 3DO M2, right? And someone's like, can you tell us how big certain things are? And so I took all these pictures of the ruler sitting next to it.
Can you measure it?
And it's like, of course, like, you want to be able to share this information. You don't want to like keep it locked in a safe in your house, right? And so, yeah, document. If you come across something cool that isn't documented, let folks know that it's out there.
Even, I mean, it's certainly not a perfect solution, but even just tweeting about it a couple of times it makes it slightly more discoverable on the internet. So that's helpful.
Absolutely.
I do want to jump back real quick, because you mentioned that a lot of people say, like, I want to share this with my kids. And, you know, you provided a lot of really good examples of other ways you can share this with your kids. This is one I've heard a lot. And I don't know. I want to caution people that your kids might not have the same fondness or excitement for having the wall of games that you do. And I think it's awesome to share this kind of stuff with friends, with kids, with family. But to not, you know, to have realistic expectations about what they might want. And as they get a little older, they might be able to just straight up tell you, like, yeah, Dad, I love collecting video games, or I think this is really cool, or, you know, I like video games, Dad, but I really don't want to have to deal with moving this around and having this big, you know, collection in my house. So it's, I think that's a good one to just make sure people are thinking all the way through when they say that, because I think it's a great reason for collecting, but it might not, because anything that involves other people, you know, you're not going to be able to fully predict.
Right. And this is what we said, you know, the collecting is your personal passion. And there are things about it that you love that are not going to be shared by the people that you love. And so it's understanding that and then recognizing that, you know, they're not going to be able to tell the difference from some of this stuff. So you should really let them know, especially if it's something that's important or valuable.
Yeah. All right. Any closing thoughts about this? I think this has been a really cool discussion about a maybe not so fun topic.
No, I mean, I would say, you know, to everyone listening, like, you probably collect in some, like, even if it's not video games, it's something else, right? And just realizing that when folks pass, it's very complicated, right? That there, it's not only the emotional burden, but there can be a huge administrative burden, right? And so, thinking about that and then planning ahead. And especially if, you know, the idea is you want to see the things that you enjoyed by others while you're still alive, right? And so thinking at it from that angle, it's like, okay, what are some of the things that you can start doing now so that you and the others can enjoy those things and you can participate in that?
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. Is there anything you want to plug before you leave?
I would say subscribe to the Video Game History Foundation Patreon. we have an amazing Discord that has channels dedicated to Bubsy and Kevin's Chickens and a bunch of other cool things.
Among like historically important and interesting yeah. things. But yeah, Bubsy and Chickens and yeah, it's a fun time in there. It's a really good kind of tight-knit community of game enthusiasts and historians and researchers and stuff. It's a great resource, I think, for people. And I'm not just saying that, although maybe I am.
Well, maybe I'm a little biased. Way to plug it. Right. the best like way to put it is we have not really had to do like moderation in the server, right? Because people in there are very cool and they're super supportive. And, you know, the things like, locating someone or, hey, does anybody know a resource where I can find X? And people are there to jump in to help because we do have that shared passion. And so I appreciate everyone who has supported us so far, and I love the conversations happening in the server. So that's my plug. Join us in there and we can have further cool discussions.
I love it. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter @Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.